forum for frank talk about what people do for a living. Works Do.
Hello and welcome to Works Do. It's June 27th, 2011, and this is episode number 13. I'm Kate Gase-Walton. I'm the editor of Works Do, an online collection of essays and interviews in which people ponder their work lives. Today's episode features an interview with David Schmidt. David wears a few different hats, but it's his experience as a high-rise window cleaner that I mainly wanted to discuss today. I've spent almost all of my adult life living among skyscrapers, in New York, in Chicago, in Hong Kong. And to me, there are few urban sights more riveting than seeing someone suspended on the outside of one of these buildings, cleaning windows hundreds of feet above the street as calmly as the rest of us might wash the dishes. Whenever I see high-rise window washers, I always think of Roko Kamaj, an Albanian immigrant who worked at the World Trade Center for 26 years before he died in the 9/11 attacks on the towers. I didn't know Mr. Kamaj, although I happened to work with a relative of his. Like millions of others, I learned about his life mainly by reading about him in the New York Times. One of the things that always came across in the profiles about him was how much he loved his work. Clipped in at 1,300 feet above the street, he found a freedom in it that gave him great joy. Those two words, freedom and joy, don't come up all that often talking to people who sit all day in desk jobs. I started to think that physical labor might bring with it both a sense of lightheartedness and a sort of deep satisfaction that office jobs rarely do. That was certainly part of Samantha Cole's Works Do essay about becoming a carpenter. I could never be a high-rise window washer. I'm far too afraid of heights. But I still feel like there's something to be learned from people who are able to do this kind of work. Here's my conversation with David Schmidt. So I'm talking today to David Schmidt, who I was introduced to as a high-rise window washer. So David, I know that right now you're in your bike shop, and we're going to talk more about that later, I hope, but do you still work as a window cleaner?
Yes, I do, strangely. I was just doing that this morning, very bright and early at dawn, helping a friend of mine. I still love to do it. It's always been, I kind of grew up doing it, kind of my formative years, you know, in the 20s and 30s, and raised my family doing that, and I always have a place in my heart for that, and it's, you know, what I do now is very different, but I often, you know, at least once a month I like to get out and do that.
How did you get into this business?
Well, it was just, you know, 20 years old, just kind of at that soul-searching point where, like, you know, do I go to college? What am I doing? And I'm the youngest of five kids, and all my brothers and sisters went to college, and I was just never was made for that. So I ran into a guy who had a company and started doing that, just kind of cleaning windows on the ground, and then we started doing this stuff. It's called bosun chair work, rappelling off the sides of buildings, which is just... You know, it was just so liberating and fun. And, you know, as a kid, as a young man, it's just like, you know, it puts you to the test. And yeah, I mean, there's just an amount of freedom at that age and able to make money, you know, for the first time. And so anyway, it just turned into like, you know, a year became 2 years, it became 3 years. And then I ended up meeting actually a really old kind of soul, this guy named Tom Sedgemore, who was had a reputation as kind of a hard ass, and he had a small company he's had in Seattle since I think his brother started actually in the late 20s, in the 30s, down in Tacoma. And Tom was a really old guy when I met him, but he was fascinating because he was it wasn't just the window cleaning. It was like a lot of the guys that are interesting in this trade, you know, they have other things going on. They have other pursuits. And Tom's, his thing, he's a boatwright, a shipwright, back from the, you know, the 40s and 50s and 60s in Seattle, working on all the old fish boats and stuff. So he had kind of like a really kind of a deep sort of dimension to him. And he would make all sorts of crazy gadgets for us to rappel off of, these cool aluminum structures and really clever designs that would roll on top of the buildings and clamps. And so anyway, we became friends. I started subbing from him, which is kind of what a lot of guys do. Sub work is kind of how you function. You have a company, your own little business, but you go work for, you know, for cash for guys as a sub. And so I started working for Tom, and we became friends, you know, even though he was 45 years older than I was. His big thing in every single day was that we had to have lunch, and it was a very long, you know, hour and a half event, 2 hours, and always followed by pie. And I was like one of the first guys who actually would do that with him, you know, and certainly as a young kid, you know, 23 years old, and so we became good friends. And so it came to a point where he was like, you know, I want you to buy my business. I want to do something else. I want to invent some stuff, and I need cash, and, you know, here's the price of the business, and buy me out. And I kind of freaked out at the time. I was like, you know, I really should be doing something like go to school, but I decided I needed to make a decision, so I just I took what money I had and went off to Spain for 6 months and lived over there and traveled, and with the intention of coming back and buying Tom's business, and that's what I did. I felt actually a kind of a drawn loyalty to come back and help out a guy who certainly helped me out, kind of gave me an opportunity. So I felt some sort of a loyalty there. And I came back to the U.S. and Tom and I kind of worked out a deal, and I took over his business. And back then, you know, this was like 1994 or something. And, you know, he had like one of the first cell phones. It was one of those ridiculous kind of walkie-talkie things. And I remember I just plopped it down on the table at lunch. We're at the Crocodile Cafe in Seattle, and, you know, which is a funny punk rock sort of bar that Tom used to love to go to, which is for an old kind of conservative guy, it was very funny. But he plumped it down, and that was it.
So tell me more about the actual work. You mentioned bosun's chair work, which I assume is different from, say, standing on a platform.
Yeah, it's not like you just go up there and just like click into something. That's not the way it works. And bosun chair work, yeah, and the kind of work when you see what are called swing stages on the sides of buildings, those mm-hmm. are the platforms, and those are mechanical. You know, they're electric. They go up and down, and on a winch, basically, right? Two little motors, electric motors. Those things are static. They just stay on the building. That's not what we do. We do bosun chair, so you're sitting on a piece of wood, and you know, it's a much safer way to do it, to be honest. If you know what you're doing, just because there's nothing mechanical, you're just using. You know, gravity is going through a rack that you're attached to, carabiners.
So I'm interested that you say that, because I kind of came across that in my reading. So these sort of more old-fashioned, low-tech ways are actually safer?
Very much so, yeah. If you look at actually statistics, or like any time you see window cleaners stranded, it's always a stage. Motor's broken, a cable broke, or something horrible happened, they got... generally those guys are, you know, they're just basically janitors that are stuck on a platform. You know, there's nothing wrong with that, but they're also not qualified to jump over the side and rappel. That's why, I mean, you know, I could get off a stage if it broke. I know how to get off of it, but those guys don't, you know. So they have to get rescued by the fire department. And if something catastrophic happens, they're hosed.
Right.
they're not really, the way the laws work with labor and industry, in fact, the harnesses and stuff people are required to wear are actually completely unsuited for getting yourself self-arresting yourself. What we wear in bosun chair is all climbing. It's all climbing gear, basically. Climbing and boat stuff. So, you know, it's very lightweight. It's sit harnesses. You're able to go up or down. You're able to do things. Whereas the industry in general has what are called full body harnesses, which are attached in the back behind your shoulder blades. So if you were to fall, you hang like a rag doll, and there's nothing you can do. So you have to be rescued. Whereas when we fall, it's you're in a sit harness. You're able to actually function because it's right above your crotch, you know, where you're hanging from.
Right. So it's like rock climbing gear. Basically.
Yeah, it's exactly it's rock climbing gear, and so it's a very different attitude. We use hooks and. The guy Tom, I bought my business when we designed some beautiful hooks for overhangs that a system we did a lot of and in Seattle. It's called line transfers, and so it's kind of one of my specialties on buildings with a big overhang sticking out. Mm-hmm. So there'll be, like, the roof will stick out, and then the glass. When architects design these, they often don't think of how anyone's going to ever reach the glass, especially at the very top floor. Mm-hmm. And it's a problem, you know. People pay $1 million for an apartment or something, you know, and their glass is uncleanable, you know. So you have to figure out ways to get to it. And these, you know, these hooks, you'd put over the hooks, and then you go over on one line, and then you would, you basically have two lines. You'd swing in and transfer from one rope to the other rope, and brings you in close to the building, and you're able to do it. But so yeah, I mean, there's the challenge is that's frankly what the fun part is. It's, you know, standing on a platform going down. It gets pretty old pretty quick, you know.
So how did you learn to do all of these maneuvers? Is it all learned on the job? Is there any training?
It's all learned on the job. And, you know, I mean, that's you know, there's probably, I can count on one hand the guys that I would work with that I would allow to, you know, tie my lines. And we do that all day long where, you know, you're working and you're rigging and you're doing something else and your buddy's rigging your lines. And you never go look at it. You just jump over the side, and, you know, and it can be pretty complicated sometimes. And so those kind of develop into good friendships and business relationships, or just sort of unspoken sort of trust, obviously. Yeah, and you learn things from guys all the time. Everyone does stuff different, and it's always funny. It was always funny to work with guys, especially for the first time. You're just like, oh, what's that? What do you got? What do you have? You know, what are you doing? You're crazy, you know. And there's guys that were crazy. I mean, there was this one guy, won't mention him by name, but he had what we all called the suicide rock, and it was just literally a 5-gallon bucket filled with concrete. And then he put a piece of rebar in it, so it was just like sticking out of the top. And this is very effective, actually, and I used it after a while, but it would just be on a dolly. He just rolled that up to the roof, and he'd click into that, and that was it.
So what kind of personalities did you find that this business attracted? Are they thrill seekers, or are they actually kind of very safety-conscious, deliberate people?
Very deliberate people, actually. Everyone I worked with, and it's all over the place, obviously, Kate. I mean, there was guys I worked with that are hardcore convicts, hardcore, hardcore, you know, coke heads and meth heads, a lot of that. There's a lot of that in the industry. But at a kind of a level that that's why I worked for myself. When you work for some of the companies, that's basically everyone. You know, you're picking guys up from the jail on the way to work kind of thing, you know. And it's a transient sort of, you know, job. A lot of guys are traveling all over the country doing it, you know, mm-hmm. One place to the next, living in motels. Yeah, and then there was a strangely in Seattle kind of like this kind of crazy kind of Christian cult thing too, and that was
right.
So then there's that, and then, you know, I kind of fell into a group of guys a little bit more independent minded. Met some very close friends through that, you know, kind of more of the climbing types, mm-hmm. Mountaineers.
Are you a climber? Is that what
I'm
you
not?
Do for
no, I'm not. I'm not. No, I'm not. I'm one of the few guys that's not. I mean, I've climbed, you know, I do occasionally, but it's a very different thing.
Yeah.
Rappelling off of a building downtown is very different than hiking up and, you know, going bouldering up something.
Yeah. Is it physically exhausting work, though?
It is, yeah. It is. It's and that's what's, yeah, I mean, it's up, you're up on a building and you can be, yeah, I mean, you're sitting for one, but you're also, geez, you're kind of doing a ballet, you know. You're working laterally, you're swinging a lot, and with suction cups, so you're sticking to the building. And then when you're on the roof, obviously, you're moving heavy lines and jumping over walls and climbing things and kind of doing all sorts of things your body shouldn't really be doing. It's really exhausting, and it's kind of like part of the fun, you know. I mean,
is that part of the appeal for you, the physicality of it?
That's why I still do it. I crave it. Like now my life is, you know, running two bike shops here in Seattle and another one in Chicago, and, you know, it's answering a lot of email, you know, and I'm a file clerk, you know.
Right.
You know, and I'm sure you know all about it. And the, something about very simple, just about, you know, the older I get, just kind of like that, there is some sort of poetry in going out and just working for a hard day, and especially that, where you're actually standing in there's a project, you know, there's that much glass, You go do that, and you, you know, what does get old is that after the years that you do every building, every maybe 3 months, you kind of know it. And so kind of the thrill is gone, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I have to always remind myself, that's why I sold the business, because it was time to do that. But at the same time, when I go back and do it, there's just, it's so simple, and it feels so good. At the end of the day, you're tired, and a beer tastes really good, and, you know, it feels satisfying, you know. And you made your money, and it was honest work, you know.
That wraps up the show for today. Thanks again very much to my guest, David Schmidt. Thanks also to everyone who's contributed an essay to WorkStew. And finally, thanks very much to you for listening today. The next episode will be released in 2 weeks, and I hope you'll check it out. In the meantime, please let me know what you thought of the show by sending an email to kate@workstew.com, by posting a comment on the WorkStew website, or by writing a review for iTunes. Thanks again, and bye for now.